You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Traditionally, the session after lunch is a little bit difficult after you've eaten. It's a little slower pace. And so we've prepared a particularly dynamic set of speakers for you to keep you engaged, awake, enthusiastic, and certainly I'm excited to discuss the subject. The topic this afternoon is challenges of disaster risk management in Asia and the transferability of Japan's best practices. You know, if you look back to the 1995 Kobe earthquake that several people mentioned on this morning, there has been a lot of good learning that's come out of that. The whole development of strategies of disaster risk reduction and the Hyogo framework, and discussions are taking place about these issues now in a way that they weren't before the earthquake. I think sometimes it's good for us to remember that we do learn. I mean, we can learn from terrible experiences. Things and systems and people can get better. And so this afternoon we're going to talk about some of the advances and challenges in disaster risk management, particularly in Asia, to see the extent to which some of Japan's experiences might be useful. The format will be similar to this morning. I'm going to introduce very briefly each of the four speakers. You have their bios in your pack. Then they're one at a time come to the podium and speak for the amazing limitation of 10 to 12 minutes each. This is a tremendous burden on you folks, but I know that you're up to the challenge in this post-lunch period. Then we'll come up here and have a discussion and time for questions. So without further ado, I'll say that we'll begin with James Fleming, who's Division Chief for Asia, Latin America, and Eurasia Response Division. Think about that for a minute. Asia, Latin America, Eurasia, that's Europe and Asia. In other words, everything except sub-Saharan Africa. So tremendous responsibility at USAID. He's worked with USAID for a number of years, also the International Organization of Migration. Then we'll turn to Megumi Mutu, who is Deputy Director General for Southeast Asia and the Pacific Department of JICA. He's done a lot of work on Latin America, the Philippines, finance, and so on. Then we'll turn to the ambassador from Indonesia to the United States, who's been with the foreign ministry since 1986, posted in places as diverse as New York, Geneva, and Aceh. And then we'll turn to Rebecca Scherer, who's director of the Red Cross, Red Crescent Global Disaster Preparedness Center, long years of experience with many different disasters. I think you said more than 20, from Haiti to Pakistan, working mainly with the American Red Cross and others. So James, we'll begin with you. Please come up. Thank you.
Afternoon, everyone. Let me start by just saying thank you to Brookings for hosting this event and for inviting me as well. I'm glad to be here. As you heard from Nancy Limborg over lunch, USAID is strongly committed to disaster risk reduction and disaster risk management. It's also an honor to be here on a personal level. When I think of the big disasters like Japan, the Asia tsunami of 2004, 2005, I feel that how we honor the people who have been killed in a disaster, or who families who have been affected by a disaster, I think the way that we honor them is to take lessons learned from that disaster and then apply those lessons learned so that that disaster does not happen again. So I think this is a really good opportunity to discuss some of the lessons learned going forward from Japan and a variety of other disasters. So clearly there are a lot of lessons from the disaster in Japan, and I will discuss how USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, or OFDA, is applying those lessons from Japan in other countries, as well as lessons from, you know, 50 years of responding to other disasters around the world. And I'm going to focus my comments up front this morning, or this afternoon, on Indonesia, Philippines, and Thailand. And then during the discussion, I'd be happy to answer questions on any other country or topic. So these three countries have similar disaster risk profiles to Japan in certain ways, maybe not nuclear power plants, but certainly in the areas of seismic risk and hydrometeorological hazards. Another common thread between Japan and Indonesia, the Philippines, and Thailand is that all countries have made very strong political and financial commitments to disaster risk management. So to start, just a brief bit of background on USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. So essentially, we use the same definition for disaster risk reduction as the UN's International Strategy for Disaster Reduction, ISDR. Second, we support the ISDR Hyogo Framework for Action through essentially three things. That's policy, it's global engagement, and it's funding. Most of you are familiar with our funding, and that's what I'll concentrate on. Our funding focuses on, you know, three basic areas in DRR. That's enhancing resilience, reducing vulnerability, and increasing capacity. So this funding includes both standalone DRR programs as well as mainstreaming DRR into both response and recovery programs. And you heard Nancy Lindborg talk about the percentage of our funding that goes to DRR. And in the last fiscal year, the funding total was actually 12% went to DRR, and this is both mainstreaming and standalone projects. And that varies between 10% and 20% on any given year. So, of course, DRR activities are tailored for the specific context in which we're working. So turning to Indonesia, our office supports a number of disaster risk reduction programs, a country that's affected by a variety and frequent number of natural disasters. So our DRR activities focus on prioritizing and strengthening early warning, disaster preparedness, mitigation, and prevention. Among the specific DRR programs that USAID OFTA supports, one example through the American Red Cross, we are assisting vulnerable communities living in coastal areas to harness local ecosystems to mitigate the impact of storms by, for example, rehabilitating coastal mangrove forests as well as green belts. As Indonesia is one of the world's most volcanically active nations, USAID provides technical assistance and monitoring to the government of Indonesia in partnership with the U.S. Geological Survey. Since 2004, we have also supported training in seismic monitoring and eruption forecasting. We support programs that address the psychosocial effects of disasters by training first responders to provide care after a disaster strikes. In another example, we build capacity of local microfinance institutions for disaster-affected populations. And we fund programs that educate communities and local officials on climate change adaptation that improves provincial and district-level linkages. So when it comes to disaster risk reduction, OFDA has a very strong partner in the government of Indonesia. Between 2006 and 2012, the government of Indonesia has nearly doubled its investment in disaster risk reduction and currently funds about 1% of its budget on DRR locally. The Indonesian government is also working on a tsunami master plan. This plan is an ambitious multi-year program to improve early warning and preparedness for tsunamis. But not all the DRR is structural and highly technical. A lot of these examples of DRR are simple and pretty straightforward. In West Timor, for example, USAID often supports a program that promotes the use of radio early warning systems in the preparation of basic water and food storage facilities to ensure that necessities are available following a disaster. So, in April 2012, there was the large earthquake off the coast of Indonesia. And the alerts that had been set up after 2004-2005 tsunami actually worked very well. And as you heard Nancy Lindborg say, we had hundreds of thousands of people that were moved away from coastal areas after that earthquake happened. There wasn't a tsunami generated, but what we saw is the effectiveness of these early warning and notification systems. Another particular item I'd like to mention with respect to Indonesia is a local partner called Ambulon 118. Ambulon 118 was a small Indonesian medical disaster response organization, and with international support, it has grown into a premier response entity in the country. So when a disaster strikes, they have staff that are ready to respond rapidly and effectively should the occasion warrant. So I will turn to the Philippines. Between 1990 and 2012, USAID responded to more than 40 disasters in the Philippines, including volcanic eruptions, drought, typhoons, and flooding. Our DRR investments in the Philippines focus on the most vulnerable. Examples of DRR programs in the Philippines include providing technical support to enhance the government's response capability, improve vulnerability assessment and mapping, mainstreaming DRR into public schools, and through fire and earthquake drills. We also support capacity building for the Philippine Red Cross. The government of the Philippines, through lots of practice, has been responsive, efficient, and effective in responding to disasters. This is a civilian-led, but includes inputs from assets from the national government, the military, and the private sector. The government has demonstrated a strong commitment to DRR through a number of key mechanisms, including progressive DRR laws, through which the government has established the policy framework for effective DRR, and has provided funding at all levels to undertake DRR activities. With support from USAID, over the past 4 years, the government has instituted the Incident Command System as a standing response framework for all hazards in the Philippines. The Philippines is also assessing the challenge of global climate change with agroforestry practices included in local and national development plans. So an example in the Philippines, since 1998, USAID has helped train professional emergency responders in the Philippines. This program has been instrumental in staffing Philippine search and rescue first responders. And groups like the Philippines National Red Cross, the Bureau for Fire Protection, the Office of Civilian Defense, and even the Armed Forces. At a national level, USAID has enabled the World Food Program specialists to assist Philippine governments with mapping hazard-prone areas and improving warehouse management of relief items. Third, the USAID and U.S. Forest Service has worked together to train Philippines emergency personnel in what is known as the Incident Command System, ICS, and we'll talk more about that. Last, in Thailand. Thailand is a country, as we discussed, prone to typhoons, floods, tsunamis, and USAID funds a number of DRR initiatives in close coordination with the Thai government. This includes distribution of primary school education materials that teach children ways to prepare and respond to disasters, and this information is flowing from the children to the families in Thailand, and it's been a very successful endeavor. USAID is also helping strengthen the capacity of the Thai government's Department of Disaster Prevention and Mitigation and related national and local institutions to develop and implement flood mitigation and preparedness projects. In Thailand as well, we are helping institute the Incident Command System for the government as well. So following the unusually severe flooding of 2011, the Thai government dramatically increased its investment in flood mitigation, including the allocation of approximately $11 billion for flood prevention, including forest restoration and conservation, and the construction of dikes, reservoirs, and water retainers. And they have invested in flood early warning systems and information management as well. So these three countries have all made laudable strides in disaster preparedness and response to address the significant natural hazards they face. These countries' rich disaster risk management experience at all levels can also be leveraged to build regional capacity. To further strengthen DRM, it is crucial that governments and international donors mainstream DRM into development programs, as Nancy Lindborg reiterated at lunch. By working closely with our development partners, we will help maximize the continuity and depth of DRM initiatives, thereby reducing the economic and human toll of natural disasters. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Megumi Muto from Japan International Cooperation Agency, JICA. While my fellow speakers focus on people, I will cover the issue of planning on hard structures. In fall 2010, I was also in D.C. to launch a joint study with the ADB and the World Bank titled Climate Change and Adaptation in Asian Megacities. There, we did some initial attempts to downscale global circulation models to call attention to the potential magnitude of floods in 2050 under climate change, and then suggested to apply that methodology to planning. I then moved on to manage JICA's portfolio to the Philippines for 2 years, and the presentation today is to share my, I would say, struggle to apply science, not just in very nice studies to be kept on the bookshelf, but to the real-world setting of Metro Manila. Climate change is a real challenge for planning. First, in terms of planning horizon, the life cycle of flood control structures is up to 40 to 50 years, and the current decision will be locked in for decades. In order to do no-regret planning, we have to be accountable for future generations, making use of the best of our knowledge. Then, how can we assist partner countries for no-regret planning? I think that we need to make sure that they are well-informed by rigorous science and assist in broad-based decision-making. I underlined rigorous science because this is the area my team in JICA is really focusing on at this moment. What science can tell us? The challenge of climate change on planning. Number one, effect of climate change is not linear, but it affects the peak events. Flood control structures are intended to protect people, assets, and activities from peak flood events. So the extent of increase in peak precipitation directly affects structure design of flood control. So we need to downscale global circulation models to calculate the increase in peak precipitation. In the next few slides that I borrowed from Professor Koike of the University of Tokyo and IPCC, who is working on the analysis of Metro Manila at this moment, I try to share with you a snapshot of what we do in downscaling global circulation models. First, what are global circulation models? There are 20-something global circulation models used for the future scenario analysis of the IPCC. These models are developed by institutions worldwide, including in the U.S., Europe, and Japan. Some of you have heard about the Earth Simulator, which is one of these models developed in Japan. They are models with mega amounts of data, and even the fastest supercomputers cannot accommodate all the necessary simulation. Examples of major variables in the global circulation models are shown in this slide, depicting the dynamics of global energy and water cycle. But please don't ask me questions on this slide. I cannot answer. Okay. All right. taken individually, these global circulation models from number 1 to 24 have their own strengths and weaknesses. Some are very good in precipitation, some are very good in winds. So at IPCC, they choose some subset of models that perform well in the context of the analysis that they are conducting and do what they call multi-model analysis. At the global level, as you may have heard many times, the global circulation models project that there will be changes in extreme events. It is very likely that precipitation events will continue to become more frequent, and also it is likely that the area affected by drought increases. Now we turn to the local level. This is an example of multi-model analysis for peak precipitation in Indonesia. Here, daily rainfall of 5, 10, 100-year return periods are analyzed. In one scenario, A1B, almost all the models show that the same trend and probable rainfall of 5, 10, and 100 years will increase by around 20 to 30%, while the same analysis based on B1 scenario shows relatively less severe results. A1B or B1 refers to the scenario IPCC sets, assuming varieties in socioeconomic growth. Then, how do we apply such results from science to the real-world structure planning? When applied to hydrological model, the discharge of water at peak will increase, meaning more flooding. Then, the design rainfall, which is the assumption on peak precipitation when designing a flood control structure, will change. In designing structures under climate change, we would wish to do this right, well informed by science, but I don't think we can never be completely right. Just as a footnote, we do not intend to prevent all the flood. We assume a mixture of structural and also non-structural measures. The second challenge of planning under climate change is spatial distribution. The coverage and depth of flood, the 3D, depend critically on the spatial distribution of peak precipitation. Just as a simple example, where the flood occurs depend critically on which side of the mountain you're talking about. Therefore, we need to downscale global circulation models not just in terms of increase of peak precipitation, but also in terms of the spatial location of peak precipitation. This is the upper watershed of Metro Manila, and in an ideal case, we might wish to simulate locally on a scale, for example, close to several square kilometers. Then, how we get there? An ensemble of global circulation models, like these slides shown in the neighborhood of the Philippines, can usually be downscaled up to 100 square kilometers. Even under the fifth IPCC report now in process, scientists are arguing if the scale can be narrowed to 60 square kilometers. But to predict flood, we need to know if the rain falls on the right-hand side of the mountain or the left-hand side. So we need to go another round of analysis. This time, using the historical data of rain gauges in the localities of Metro Manila, the 100-kilometer wide peak precipitation data is spatially allotted to localities with some weight driven from historical data. And here you see examples of global circulation model peak precipitation data corrected in terms of spatial distribution. After getting the spatial distribution of peak precipitation, then we move on to hydrodynamic models. I have just inserted this slide to show you that the model that Professor Koike is using for Metro Manila now is not only on water, but takes into consideration the dynamics between the soil and the atmosphere, thus improving the fit of the calibration quite substantially. and combining the downscale peak precipitation and hydrodynamics, we clearly see the increase in peak flood volume in red that lead to flood maps such as the one shown in the next slide. As Professor Koike and his team is working on the latest flood simulation right now, this flood analysis is taken from the 2010 study that I have done. My version in 2010, as it is commented from A to B, has many lessons learned. So my colleagues, including Professor Koike, are correcting all my errors in the past. Okay, one remaining challenge. Policymakers have to agree on likely future scenario, even though we inform them with all these scientific results. Spatial pattern of flood varies depending on the downscaling results, but policymakers tend to center decision on one recent historical event. For example, in the case of Metro Manila, they tend to focus on the story of Typhoon Ondoy Pepen in 09. This is, I think, this occurs because it is easier to convince constituencies and stakeholders. So maybe in this setting, political consensus is favored over science. But can this be no regret planning? That is the question that I pose to myself. I don't know the answer because it is public choice, but the one who has to decide on certain projects that we do in the Philippines, I just couldn't say yes to the political choice and stop there. Rather, I offered some additional work to correct the data, and that's why we have engaged Professor Koike. This slide shows what happened with the flood control master plan in Metro Manila historically. In 1990, JICA did a master plan of flood control in Metro Manila without any consideration of climate change. 2010, ADB, JICA, and the World Bank, we did joint study on climate change and adaptation in Asian megacities, as I have mentioned. This was a study, so it was easy to do. No responsibility at all. But then, 2011 master plan, the World Bank assisted the government of the Philippines to come up with a master plan with certain assumptions on precipitation peak increase. I'm not blaming the World Bank. It was the government of Philippines who made the political decision that this master plan has to be built on a single event of Typhoon Ondoy Pepen and in 09. I thought that this has the potential to be regret planning, so we offered a complementary work that we are doing at this moment. Way forward. Assisting partner countries in long-term planning under climate change is an emerging case of cutting-edge science-based ODA from Japan. We want to more capacitated to do this. Informing on choices through science can be done, but challenges remain in the communication strategy and decision-making mechanism within the partner country. This is very, very important, but I don't have the answer to this at this moment. Donor coordination on a shared platform of science is becoming increasingly important, and JICA is willing to take the lead on this. Thank you very much.
Very good afternoon to you all. Let me begin by thanking the Brookings Institute, Brookings Institutions for inviting me to come to this event. Just small correction, Elizabeth. I am not the Indonesian ambassador to the United States, but I am ambassador of Indonesia to the United Nations. Slightly different, but the implication is very wide. So I'm based in New York. It is certainly a distinct pleasure for me to be given the opportunity to share with you of all Indonesia's experience to strengthen resilience, preparedness, and capacities in dealing with disaster. I'm just wondering, how many of you have been to Indonesia? Thank you very much. Quite a lot. But if you look at the map, at the shade is the size of the United States, but you never imagine how big Indonesia is. In terms of island lands and territorial water, and what is more important, we are also what you call it inhabiting what we call it the Pacific Ring of Fire and the Alpine Belt at the same time. So the record and the facts will strike us, such as Indonesia is the 12th rank among countries which relatively high risk because of disaster. Number 12. It's quite amazing. You name it. Earthquake, volcanoes, flood. What else, James?
Name it.
We have it. But I am proud to say that Indonesians are resilient. We are resilient. And also now at the UN, we are now trying to measure happiness index. It is not there yet, but I am truly believe that Indonesia will not be one of the lowest, because in terms of resilience, we are very strong. What strike us? What really trigger Indonesia? Then suddenly, DRR become the mainstream in our policy, become the everybody's issues. Certainly, tsunami. Tsunami 2004. Along with many other natural resources, there is also for us a need then to strengthen and increase DRR capacity to minimize the vulnerabilities and disaster risk. In the case of Indonesia, this is really a critical step to help us sustain our development effort. Luckily, we do also have at international level the HYOGO Framework for Action 2005-2015. So it really helped us how to implement it, how to put priorities, and help also formulating the program. We have made DRR as a priority in our disaster management strategy. We include these strategy schemes to increase, again, resilience and partnership at national, regional, as well as global levels. Many have been said that about the establishment of National Agency for Disaster Management and also the participation of local government. So again, not only that, I think the participation of civil society, parliamentarians, nearly everyone in Indonesia. For that reason, we do also believe there is a need to have a strong legal basis on DRR through the establishment of Law 24 in 2007. We also recognize the importance of coherence and coordination in the implementation of this law, especially within the central government as well as the local government. We believe, again, DRR is very important to sustain our development, and it also helps save and preserve the achievements of our development effort. And luckily, because of the mainstreaming of DRR, we have been able to integrate DRR into our midterm national development plan 2010 and 2014. In this regard, DRR is very critical to our efforts in realizing the vision towards Indonesia's resilience to disaster. The threat of natural disaster, again, very constant. I think James has agreed with me that you name it, we have it. Again, then, when the disaster struck, who suffered the most? I think you would agree with me, certainly people or local people. For that reason, we pay attention to the local governments that have to first tackle challenges in the aftermath of disaster. And the local government, certainly, they have to respond first in this particular regard. That's why capacity building of local governments are very, very important. We also begin to establish what we call it the Indonesia Disaster Risk Index, in which we develop inventory of hazards, vulnerabilities, and capacities of all local governments. And in this regard, there are 494 districts we identified, which consider as areas that could easily fall or fall into medium, high, medium, and low risk zones. And also, it is disheartening to note that 396 districts are situated in high-risk zones and are highly vulnerable to various type of disaster. Allow me now to share with you a few thoughts on how we can strengthen capacity for DRR. I'm a bit nervous because you are showing me the timing, right? Thank you. First, strengthen local resilience through the development of disaster resilient villages. It is in these villages that we mostly witness the devastating effects of natural disasters, earthquake, tsunami, landslide, volcanic eruption, floods have often took place in rural areas. In this archipelagic, I think you will be also struck to know that Indonesia has around 17,000 islands. I think, can you imagine? The number itself cannot be fixed depending on the tide up and down. Then if it is high tide, then we have less island. But more or less, we agree, and it has become a national consensus, more than 17,000 islands. Very rich, very challenging. In the archipelagic area, we adjust our DRR initiative to the geographic characteristic of our villages. We call it Kampung Siaga for inland areas and Desa Pesisir or resilient coastal villages for coastal areas. They are trying to serve and they are established to serve the objective of creating community-based DRR at the local level. I still have 5 minutes. These villages can be part of wider networks for the implementation of DRR plans and strategies. Second, participation and collaboration of multi-stakeholders is very critical to build capacity for DRR. Academics, religious leaders, civil society, professional parliamentarians, youth, especially, they are all involved in this process as well. I'm not going to through all. And third, human capacity and technical capacity need to be developed. This is also one of our great challenges. But we also tried our best to maintain and apply what we call it local wisdom, because through generation in each of the culture, we also have what we call it local wisdom as well as indigenous knowledge. And fourth, financing is very critical, certainly. And one of the way to obtain financing support is through what we call it, and it is very popular now at the UN, public-private partnership you can also bring in philanthropists, private sector, business, etc. And lastly, there must also be coherence between national and local capacity. I think Jim has said quite on this as well. There is a need. There is also a challenge to make it coherent synergy between the central and local government. Distinguished participants, in view of the above, the Indonesian government established the vision and priorities on building the resilience of the nation at all levels. Currently, there are four approaches being implemented to enhance the resilience preparedness measures and capacities in disaster risk reduction. First, what we call it the anticipative approach. Anticipative approach. This is taken by conducting further research, studies, and innovation that can be used to enhance the creation of early warning systems. And second, what we call it the aversion approach. Aversion approach is to avert the emerging risks through various means, both structural and non-structural. For example, rebuilding the Sabo dams in Yogyakarta because of the Mount Merapi eruption to contain massive volcanic eruption. Law enforcement to eliminate the practice of burning peatlands and clearing methods and intensive effort for the plantation of mangrove trees. Third, it is the adaptive approach. By taking anticipative and risk-aversion approaches, then the people must also be willing to adapt in order to enhance their resilience to disaster. Fourth, the resilience approach. It is important to raise the awareness on resilience and aiming for it. With the given geographic condition of the country, which to a certain extent has been affected by climate change and variations of in climate, the Indonesian have no other choice but to live with disasters. And this is the point, the crux of the resilience. In conclusion, Indonesia is always attaches the utmost importance to international cooperation and support, particularly to address the remaining challenges in promoting disaster risk and in improving the capacity of Indonesia to share its experience and knowledge to others as well. It is, in fact, the strong partnership between the government of Indonesia and international partners. I think James, again, has made it very clear, one of the examples. This kind of partnership has made significant progress possible in the efforts of building preparedness and resilience in the country. Once again, thank you very much.
Minasama, konnichiwa, watashi wa Rebecca Sandes. So, thank you very much for having us at Brookings here today. It's a real pleasure for me to have a chance to talk to all of you a little bit and share some perspective from the Red Cross and Red Crescent side of this equation. I think we've heard there are a lot of different ways to broach disaster risk reduction and resilience, risk management, however you want to call it. It's a big endeavor, and it requires all of us playing a role. So I will take the next 10 minutes or so to try to encapsulate some of the work that we're doing and a different perspective. In particular, I'd like to really concentrate on urban, just a second here, from the beginning, here we go, on urban resilience and what it means for the Red Cross network. I've selected a few questions here to just get us started, so I'll try to address these as best I can as we go forward, and I'll try to talk slowly. I have a tendency to talk quickly. I really want to talk about how is urban disaster management risk management different from the rural setting from a Red Cross perspective, and how is it impacting us? What are we seeing as some of the positive aspects of the urban trends that you're hearing about? You've heard a lot of statistics. Nancy Lindbergh shared a bunch over the lunch hour. We're really grappling with a massive migration of population globally to urban centers. Obviously, I think you're all pretty well aware that roughly half the world right now lives in urban areas, and we're looking at a projection of that possibly reaching 70% in, 2050. These are estimations, but it really drives home the point that this is a critical time for us to gear up and be more effective with our preparedness. And then I just want to talk a little bit about the Red Cross network. You know, how can we really advance these efforts? We're not the only game in town, but we certainly have some considerable reach. So when we're looking at urban settings, you know, traditionally the Red Cross has really focused more on rural areas. We have a pretty good sense of how to do vulnerability and capacity assessments that take weeks. We get to know the community. They're easy to identify. We can quickly go into a small area, a town, and understand who the community elders are and have them advise us. They trust us. It's an easy mechanism for us to access for delivering humanitarian assistance. When we get into an urban setting, we're faced with huge challenges around accessing populations, targeting the right people, the most vulnerable, and really reaching the scale, hitting the density of need that we see there. It's a whole different ballgame when we have that kind of congestion. Sandy drove home the whole challenge around vertical assistance. When you come up to a high rise and you have 10 stories, 12, 20, 30, 40, whatever it is, it posed huge challenges for us, especially when there's no electricity and you have elevators and people elderly and disabled on these floors. One truck with 10,000 meals doesn't go very far when you hit a high rise. So we're looking at the Jakartas and Dhakas and other places in the world and realize this is a whole different ballgame and we need to really change our thinking. Also, this issue of fluid dispersed communities, they're not easy to define in urban settings. We know there are neighborhoods, according to zip codes or blocks and such, and that helps us target. But really, you have different communities, whether they're, schools or your work setting, then you're commuting, but very fluid populations in urban settings. And there's also a lot of obvious unplanned growth and illegal settlement, so people that are invisible. And they're the ones we really want to help and reach. So these are compounded vulnerabilities. Also, there's economic migration, which I think you're all aware of, as well, this interplay between the rural and urban centers. And a lot of times we're seeing, for example, unaccompanied minors that go to the city to earn money for their families and come back. Well, these are very vulnerable people that we're trying to reach. Catch up with my slide here. So it's not all bad. I think that's one thing we have to remember is that we really have opportunities in front of us as well when we're looking at urban settings and how we can do a better job. When you have this concentrated wealth that you oftentimes find in urban centers as economic engines of societies, that also comes with greater education opportunities and more people with assets. So there's more of an interest to protect those assets. We have more engagement oftentimes with local government. And this is a real opportunity for us to strengthen the ties with communities and make sure that the government is engaged with the civil society groups and do what we can to reinforce those relationships. Technology is more readily available. That's obvious. And I think that there are ways to capture that. I very much appreciate Mr. Bosner's comments about, relying on the low tech that's out there, the megaphones and, just communicating with your neighbors is critical, and I think that will remain to be the case, but there are certainly opportunities in front of us that we need to capitalize on. The private sector, I look at that as a whole different swath of capacity that's really concentrated in urban areas as a different range of professional services that we could tap. So it's just to demonstrate that, there's some assets there for us to explore. Then, I always do that. Okay,
So then, you know, what are we really aiming for? I just wanted to throw this up. This doesn't encapsulate everything. Obviously, resilience is a big term, and there are a lot of different approaches to it. Let me start by saying when you hit a community, they don't care if you're coming from a humanitarian angle or you're coming from development. It doesn't matter to them. But what we're looking for is how do we safeguard people and their families and their assets? And obviously, education really works or helps us achieve a more resilient community, more skills, emergency response systems with access to timely, accurate information. And then this last point I think is really important. We've learned over the years that we really need to focus on diversifying livelihoods. How do people earn a living? And buffer it with different ways for income generation. And also then looking at our response options and looking at these, how do we jumpstart local economies and with local procurement, cash, other options, which I'll get into in a minute here. So now we're getting to the Red Cross Network. How much time do I have? So I'm doing okay. Okay, this is a huge, huge network. And it's actually interesting that, you know, many of the NGOs out there also tap the volunteer base that we have. We've been operating now for 150 years. There are 187 countries that comprise or make up this network. The International Federation for Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, IFRC, sorry for the acronym, is sort of our coordinating umbrella. And ICRC, the International Committee for Red Cross, oftentimes focuses on the conflict zones. So together we have a pretty, an impressive reach, I would say. We have thousands of branches. And so just about every community around the world has some access to Red Cross services. And another point I want to drive home is that the communities that we're serving and those volunteers are actually coming from government, from the private sector. So it's a real mishmash of society, and I think that's a real asset for us to keep in mind. I'm particularly involved right now in a global disaster preparedness center, one of 12 or 13, I guess, now, centers that are affiliated with the Red Cross, but we really are an extension of their services to help build capacity of those Red Cross national societies as first responders, and then by extension, the communities that they're servicing, which I'll get into as well in a minute. How we work, similar to what James was talking about with OFTA, I think we've been influenced largely by other actors, OFTA included, and taking a more holistic, multi-hazard approach. FEMA certainly plays into this. I mean, there's a lot of advancement, I think, in this sector in general that's helped us come to the point where we're making a concerted effort to try to have much more integration in how we do business. Examples here I just threw in, like climate change adaptation. It's a huge theme for us right now. So we're looking at how putting on these different lenses helps us be more effective with our resources. And again, at the community level, they're not making the distinction if you're talking about livelihoods or you're talking about climate change. It doesn't matter. You know, what they're interested in is how do they stay safe and really progress in terms of economic development and other education and other investments that they care about. We also concentrate a lot on organizing people. We mobilize people all the time. And we get very heavily involved in contingency planning. I think we need to do a better job at connecting with local government, which I'll talk about, and other actors in country. And we're a platform for a lot of shared learning. We bring people together all over the world. So oftentimes you think of Red Cross as a convener, you know, and we want to have that space for a lot of dialogue so that we can share experiences. So I'll get to a few examples of what we're doing in urban areas. The first point, and just looking at exploring different techniques that seem to be more effective and appropriate in urban settings. One is cash, cash transfers. I think this isn't a new concept. In fact, OFTA has been doing this for well over 15 years. But the rest of the Red Cross is sort of like an ocean liner. We go a little slower than other people. But once you're on board, we're solid and we'll stick around, right? And I think that we're really seeing more and more Red Cross societies, Red Cross and Red Crescent societies, take on this challenge of looking at how we can distribute cash in urban settings, not just urban, but this is a quick way for us to get scale, which I talked about earlier. Apps, smartphone applications I'll talk to you about in a minute, as well as SMS messaging. In terms of school disaster preparedness, we do a lot with both OFDA support and other donors, other contributions to the Red Cross network, where we are trying to streamline disaster preparedness into curriculum all over the world, Nepal, Vietnam, Indonesia. It's been a real focal area for the Red Cross because we realize that it's an effective way to influence how, at the household level, families prepare. If their children come home, they have a very positive influence on the family thinking around disaster preparedness. This next program is one dear to my heart. It's the Community Action and Disaster Response. Again, with the very generous support from OFDA, we've been able to build off of a 10-country program to bring in the Red Cross Network in complementing a longer-term investment since 1998, I believe, where OFDA was really targeting first response institutions and authorities and building their capacities around disaster management. And we're bringing in the community level and teaching, teams in all the communities with considerable reach, skills like light search and rescue, first aid, other critical skills. Government engagement, we've, through this program and others, we've really been seeing some progress around ownership. In the Philippines, for example, several mayors have taken on the CADRE program and invested their own resources to roll that out. In Jakarta, I can't remember exactly the district, but there's a mayor that has also set aside land for solid waste management. So we're seeing some progress around government buy-in and expanding partnerships. I mean, this is key to us having an impact. We can't do everything ourselves, and I think we have a greater impact together. So even within the Red Cross Network, we're being less insular, and we're looking outward for different partnerships. So just a couple sentences, since I'm at my one-minute marker, a couple words on what we're doing within the Global Disaster Preparedness Center. We're looking at scale. What can we do to reach more people? We want to capitalize on new technology. The apps are, everybody in the world's going app crazy. And surprisingly, in places that you might not expect, people are able to afford smartphones. In Kathmandu, for example, I was astounded by how affordable those phones are becoming. So we're looking at reaching millions of people instead of a few thousand here and there. We're starting out with the first aid app that has been tried and tested with British Red Cross and American Red Cross. It had more than 1 million downloads in about 2 months here. And we're rolling that out. Right now we've got 16 countries in a pilot. We have another 35 national societies lined up to try this. We're using that same platform with additional funding from OFDA to target Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, Myanmar, and Thailand. Those national societies have all been eager to get on board and try out the flood preparedness app, as well as an SMS component where we will push out preparedness messaging and working with those national societies. And that's the Terra piece. That's also in Nepal. So it's just to give you a little flavor of what we're doing there. And lastly, I'd just say on research, that's a big part of what the Global Disaster Preparedness Center is focused on. We want to really marry the science with practical application. We understand what the practitioner needs are at the field level, but there's always been this disconnect. So part of our effort is to combine these pilots with research and really promulgate the learning wherever we can. In doing so, we've teamed up with the Federation, IFRC, on a community resilience research project that's taking us into all corners of the world, really looking at the key determinants around community resilience and how we define that and what fosters resilience so that we can replicate good practices. And in terms of practitioner needs assessments, just really keeping our finger on the pulse, like through social media and other mechanisms so that we understand where people are going to for information, what influences people's thinking, so we can target our support accordingly. And then lastly, we have a small grants program where we've teamed with the Response to Resilience Institute at Tulane University, and they have a network of universities around the world. We are providing funding for students to do research that matches with national society interests. So where they, in Indonesia, for example, they would have a say in saying, we want to really investigate flood preparedness, flood risk reduction, or solid waste management. So we're just getting started. Here's our website. It's a new site. The full site will be up in October. But it's not a plug about the center. This is really a plug about how do we work together And I just, you know, really welcome all of you to explore making connections with your local Red Cross and whatever country you're in. I think in Japan they did a fantastic job. Where is my colleague here? I don't know if he's still in the room, but I have to say that we were very impressed with their response, and I think we're going to learn a lot from that experience. There's a lot to draw from this whole unfortunate event, but thank you so much. Okay.
Well, thank you all very much. Thanks to the speakers. I thought it was a nice blend of different perspectives from, you know, coming from OFDA's perspective, how to support DRR efforts. Then we heard from Megumi about the efforts of JICA and long-term infrastructure. Then from the Indonesian ambassador, and I'm sorry I got your designation wrong, but we'll never do it again. About the from the view of a government on how to reduce risk, and then finally from the Red Cross about the efforts of civil society in taking disaster risk reduction forward. The floor is now open. We have about 25 minutes. If it's okay with you, we'll maybe group a couple of the questions to give more people time to ask questions. And if they don't have questions, I always do. One, two. Say in the very back first.
Thank you. For the gentleman from Indonesia, are the private homeowners in your country, are they digging underground shelters to avoid, you know, the tsunami?
Okay, underground shelters and tsunami. We'll come back to that. Next question.
Yes, Jared Mercadante, currently working with Habitat for Humanity. And I just want to follow up on Rebecca's presentation and just inquire further that recognizing that urban issues and urban disaster reduction is becoming a growing issue, how is the Red Cross investing in themselves to increase their internal capacities to effectively advise in these environments? So are they increasing capacities through staffing, through change management, through training? So just to more insight on that.
Okay, anybody else who'd like to ask a question in this round? All right, why don't we start with this, Ambassador? The question was whether people in Indonesia are building underground shelters or maybe taking other preventive measures to protect against eventual tsunamis.
Thank you very much for the question. We do certainly have the plan and program in which the cooperation between central and local government, especially the coastal area, certainly to avoid this kind of building underground, which we call it adaptive, meaning that in order to avoid similar disaster or similar fatalities, for example, in Yogyakarta or in Jakarta, now people are building houses which is more of earthquake resistance. So in the coastal area, we, the government, both central and local government, also persuade and inform the local people who are living in the coastal area not to have not to build underground in their own in their house, because it will be very fatal to them. So indeed, we are working on it. Yes.
Thank you, Rebecca. A question to the Red Cross on how you're preparing for urban disasters.
Okay, thank you. I can't speak for all the Red Cross or Red Crescent societies, but I can tell you, at the secretariat level and within the regions of the different hubs, urban issues are becoming a real priority, and they're looking at incorporating these the complexities and latest thinking and techniques into all of our strategies. So that will have a ripple effect. It's going to take some time. And I would also say, too, that there are already existing Red Cross and Red Crescent societies that have good urban skills. And we just need a means to pull people together to learn from past experience. The Iranian Red Crescent, for example, they're very adept. Turkish Red Crescent. I mean, we've got a lot of capacity already that exists in Chile and other places where they've had earthquakes and, you know, really tremendous challenges.
So part of what we're doing is also creating space for more dialogue. An example of that is last February, we brought 15 national societies together from different parts of Africa around a UNISDR event. And we had people really talking about what's working well in urban settings, in slums, and, you know, trying to share that those experiences so that we can come up with a better list of good practices that we can promote. And then, of course, we're investing in research, and that's where we come into play a little bit. So I'm sorry I don't have more concrete examples, but it is on our radar. It's a very pressing priority, and for obvious reasons. It's just becoming more relevant.
Yeah, and I was going to actually ask both James and Megumi. You know, a lot of development agencies started or have worked mainly in rural areas, and to adapt to urban environments means a change in staffing as well. I talked to somebody from an agency, not either one of yours, who said, oh, we've got 100 experts in rural development and one urban planner. But shifting that around becomes an HR question, a little bit political, where are priorities? I mean, to what extent are both USAID and JICA prepared to deal with urban threats?
So I think this is a good question. I think we are at USAID seeing a real shift from rural to urban, especially in disaster risk reduction. I think that's not just in the humanitarian side, but you're seeing this in the development side as well, bringing back the engineers and urban planners that, you know, had left the agency. But I think that this is not just at USAID. I see this in the partner organizations that we work with all over the world, the NGOs, the UN, and so forth. I think of an example in Haiti where we were looking at transitional shelter. And because in an urban environment the space was so limited, you couldn't meet the sphere standards for shelters with the regular shelters that we were used to using. So you saw people coming in and coming up with transitional shelters that were multi-leveled in order to meet the sphere standards. And this was a really interesting innovation that we saw as well. So not only personnel, but I think what you're also seeing is you're also seeing resources going toward urban DRR. And in fact, this year we have two annual program statements out, and essentially this is a request for proposals from the NGO and UN community on urban DRR in Latin America and the Caribbean and as well as Asia. And the idea is to get innovative ideas on how to do DRR and response in an urban setting. And this is where we get some of our best ideas in some of these requests for proposals. So that's a couple of ideas I had.
Thanks, Megumi.
Okay, thank you very much. From JICA's perspective, not only from a humanitarian development perspective, we think that the urban issues are very important from the point of view of supply network in Asia. You see, the flood in Thailand really destroyed the supply network in Asia at some instance. They proved to be resilient, but we were shocked by that event. So we shifted a lot of resources from rural areas to urban, in particular in Thailand. And there was one point of time where when we wanted to do some work in urban Philippines, engineers were not available because they all went to Thailand. Okay, well, that situation is getting better at this moment. But just to tell you, in the Asian, especially in the ASEAN context, what's happening with regard to the shift of priorities.
Thank you. Other questions? Oh, my goodness. How about 1, 2, 3, and then we'll move over here. We'll start with you, Mireya, and then 2 and 3.
Thank you very much. Mireya Solis from Brookings. I have two questions for Ambassador Perkaya, but they really are about trying to make the panelists talk to one another, picking on some of the points from your presentations. And I think it was really striking from Muto-san's presentation when she made the point that policymakers are going to be responding when they are planning ahead to the past disaster, right? Because it's a proven vulnerability, because there's public demand that vulnerability be addressed, and that they may be more hesitant to go into the uncharted areas of where the future disasters will be based on scientific evidence. And I was wondering, Ambassador Perkaya, if that kind of issue has come up in Indonesia. and you have confronted this difficulty of convincing policymakers that they should be actually making allowances and devoting scarce resources to those scenarios that are just backed up, if you will, by science, but where there has not yet been such an occurrence. So that's one first point that I want to raise. The second one is, Ambassador Perkaya, I was very impressed when you discussed all the steps that Indonesia has taken and how the national plan for responding to disasters was built up. And you mentioned that when Indonesia did this, that the Hyogo framework for action was very useful. But I wonder now if you were going to address, you know, here that we have the Red Cross and development agents and so forth, building from the bottom up, thinking about the Indonesian experience, if you could identify perhaps gaps, areas that are not covered in what international donors are putting forward, in what the humanitarian relief efforts are doing, that could be the value added of the Indonesian expertise, what would you point towards? Thank you.
Thank you. And the gentleman over here.
Thank you for the presentation. My name is Kohei Suzuki. I'm doing the community building support in devastated area. And I have one question that in Japan is now confronting huge issues with the community and after the earthquake. So I want to know that is there any good practice for community building after the disaster? Thank you.
Thanks. And there was another one on this side. Yes.
Hi, thank you. My name is Sarah Ellis-Pede. I'm with the Department of Homeland Security. I had a couple of questions specifically for the JICA presenter, which I appreciated your presentation. Thank you for that. So you had mentioned you do not have the answer for how to relay complex scientific climatological data to stakeholders, but I would still be interested in hearing what you have tried and how that has worked for you. That's an issue that we have here in the United States as well. And then second, I wondered if you could speak more about the no regrets planning and how you balance that with cost-benefit analysis and what the actual cost and impact on the community would be for some of the mitigation efforts that could be most successful but ultimately are quite expensive.
Thank you. Why don't we take the woman up here in front, and then we'll ask the panelists to respond.
Patsy Wong Iverson, Rosenbaum Foundation, and this question is for Mr. Fleming. If you could speak about the incident command system and how you worked with the U.S. Forestry Service. Thank you.
Okay, who would like to respond first? The first one gets to pick which questions to answer. James?
Well, since the incident command system, I'll go with that. We'll go in reverse order, perhaps. So the incident command system, it was an interesting system that was developed by the U.S. Forest Service in the 60s or the 70s, and it evolved out of a wildland fire that occurred in California. And it was such a magnitude that a number of different entities responded to that fire, local and state and federal. And there were a number of firefighters that were killed in that disaster. And what they realized is the reason that two primary reasons that those fatalities happened was that, one, the different agencies couldn't communicate with each other because of radios and so forth. The second thing is that there wasn't a unified command and control structure between these different agencies. So what Congress did is it mandated that the U.S. Forest Service develop a system that could take in multiple agencies under one command and control structure. And so they developed the incident command system. The principles of this incident command system are that it is one of the principles that it's flexible. It can expand and contract based on the size and the magnitude of the disaster. That's one of the principles. Another principle is that there is unity of command, that you only report to one person. You don't have multiple bosses. So those are a couple of the principles. The incident command system has been adopted by the United States. It's fundamental principles for our response structure in the United States. And OFDA has used that system ourselves to develop our own response teams overseas. You've probably heard of disaster assistance response teams that USAID sends to the field. It's based on these incident command systems. What we've realized is that a great way to help build capacity overseas is to impart these principles to governments that want to develop an incident command system. So what we do is we have an interagency agreement with the Forest Service that brings in these experts, and we send them to the field to help those governments develop an ICS-like system. An example is Indonesia, and this has been terrific. We've already seen remarkable results from the government of Indonesia in responding to crises, and there are a number of other examples as well. But that's a short brief on the incident command system.
Well, thank you very much. And Megumi, there are a couple of questions to you about how you translate hard science to normal people, and secondly, the issue of what is no regrets planning.
Okay, thank you very much. First, I think there was one question on the experience of Japan being maybe relevant to developing countries. Okay, let me just quote one recent example. There was a typhoon in the southern area of the Philippines in Mindanao. Usually they don't have typhoon at all, but they were hit. And the island of Mindanao is known by having Muslim communities. Okay, and there were people from JICA going there after the right after the disaster, and really collecting information on what spots of vulnerability are there. There were like major relief efforts by the government, but we tried to figure out if there is any like weakness in the operation. Maybe we communicate with the government. And it just so happens that there was a colleague of mine who was a member of the, peacekeeping operations there after the conflict. I mean, another conflict. I mean, this is a political conflict. And he was there. And he was very used to listening to the voices of the very Muslim minorities. And after the typhoon in Mindanao, he really went into these communities and tried to collect the voices and communicate to the central government agencies working in the relief population. And when I talked to him after all that, he said that he instantaneously did that because he learned from the disaster experience in Japan that there are really, I mean, pockets of vulnerabilities around, and there's a lot of return in really hearing to them. So it is just one example, but you see that some of people in JICA, for example, learn a lot from the experience in our country and really try to do the same thing in our partner countries. Okay. Now, with regard to the two questions we communication and no-regret planning. With regard to communication, we did one round of communications within the government of the Philippines, but the only one that really responded was PAGASA, which is the meteorological agency over there. So that was the result of the first round. It was only the meteorological people who understood. Okay, now with the Climate Change Commission of the Government of the Philippines, we are on the second round. Last April 23rd, we were in Manila with the people of the University of Tokyo, and we did a half-day seminar with not only the government agencies, but with the climate-related NGOs. And then they were on board. The university professors also came. The academia came into the picture as well. So I think it's coming step by step. Okay. With regard to no regret planning, thank you for the very important question. I still don't have the right answer, but it's an ongoing endeavor. Okay. One very important point that we have to bear in mind is, as development practitioners, we really know that it has to be owned by the partner countries. Whatever the outsiders or the scientists say, it has to be owned. And that is the first thing that we really have to bear in mind. And with that in mind, we could communicate very extensively with our counterparts. With our counterparts, I particularly mean Climate Change Commission, Department of Public Works and Highways, local governments, all these stakeholders. And when we communicate with them, first, the first issue is, especially with, okay, especially because it really affects the cost, we talk about whether to go for structure measures or structural measures or non-structure measures. I mean, one can make a choice of going 100% non-structural measures without a big infrastructure. And then there's another choice of really investing for big infrastructure and doing less on the social side. But the, I think the right choice should be somewhere in between. And where to choose is their choice, but we make sure that they know that big spectrum with cost calculations in mind. And with regard to the real designing of that structure, if ever they decide on a structure, we sit down with them and show the evidence from science, helping them in how to decide on the real minute levels of design. And the presentation I made was one kind of story along that line. And we were successful in convincing that we need another round of minute, like a data mining, in order to get to a better level of no regret. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. There are a couple of questions for Indonesia, and then I'll give you the community participation question. And I know that time is limited, so yes, please.
Thank you very much, Maria, for your question. I do not think that the public demand is a problem in Indonesia because we are one of the most democratic country. In fact, the issuance of Law 24, 2007, it was also as a result of public demand, public need, as well as public involvement. The problem is not on the policy making, but how we could also involve all the stakeholders. I think this is more important. Not only government, civil society, parliamentarians, they are also very important because when it comes to budgeting on the DRR, they play a very important role. Before responding to your second question, I think DRR in Indonesia is not perfect yet. It is in the making. It is in place. We are also facing challenges. For example, finance. Between the Department of Education and also the DRR, which one is more important? I think this is also a problem between a tug or between various departments. Capacity building, we are also in need to increase capacity building. The problem of autonomy, the challenge of autonomy, coordination between local and central government. Now the local government, they have more money. I think this is also a challenge. The mindset of the people, we have to mainstream DRR in the mindset of the people as well. Legal framework, plan of action programs are there, but there is also a problem of implementation. The other challenges is the unpredictability of the occurrence of disaster. We cannot predict. For example, we have 100 million now. We are ready, for example, if there is any earthquake next week. But 1 week, following week, there will be increasing occurrence of earthquakes. So this is also a big challenge. So for us, I think what is important, partnership with international actors, ICRC, we are thankful for the involvement of ICRC, IOM, UNICEF, you name it, UNDP, but there is one also a challenge among themselves, which is coordination among the international actor. They have to act together, they have to sit together, and they have to talk together. And what is also important, the assistance, the help, the relief, it has to be need-driven instead of supply-driven. One of the funny examples in Aceh, when the earthquake happened, you know what happened? Blanket came to Aceh. This is a tropical country. We don't need blanket. What we need is food, certainly, tent, and water, so not a blanket. So again, what is important, international actors, they have to talk to each other, they have to coordinate, and it has to be also need-driven And it should also involve the local people. Ownership is also very important in this. Thank you.
Sure. I'll just speak quickly. I know you're in a time crunch here. Just to give a couple examples maybe of how to engage communities following a disaster, from a Red Cross perspective, I think, you know, there are two things that come to mind. One is really informing people about what happened, what transpired, and what could they do better next time. There's a window of opportunity after a disaster. We always talk about it in the response field and saying people are alert. They want to know how to avoid the situation next time. So you can really make some advancements in terms of investments in preparedness. An example of this actually, not in the immediate aftermath, so maybe it's not the best example, but in the Philippines, the Red Cross was working very closely with PAGASA and Hydromet Services, and Red Cross supported a training program where the Hydromet Services trained the local Red Cross as first responders. And what services they provided, the tools, what were the limitations, what could they accurately predict, and what could they not do as well. And then those Red Cross actors went down to the barangay, the local levels, and kind of you had a ripple effect. But then at the end, the farmers knew, okay, if they're going to plant their seeds 2 weeks earlier, how likely is a disaster? How safe is that decision? And so we're looking for more informed decision making. How do we give communities the tools for that? One way to do this is the second point, engaging them more in the project development cycle. So when authorities come to a community and they want to invest resources, talk to the community about cost-benefit analysis. Weigh the options. Sometimes there are assumptions where maybe a local authority wants to invest in a bridge, assuming that these people were flooded and they want access to the markets. But the community, this is a good example, because the community might come back and say, no, we want you to invest in making our riverbed stronger. Protect the crops. Because if the crops get washed away with the flood, we have nothing to bring over the bridge. So, you know, you have to have this dialogue. And also, you know, maybe the mothers want to be with their children. I mean, there's a whole social component, too, that I think would really help authorities make better decisions around what to do with scarce resources.
Well, thanks to the panelists, and thanks to all of you for a good session after lunch. We have coffee and refreshments. We'll reconvene in 15 minutes, but join me in thanking the panelists.